Blog Talk Radio.
This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, and you are listening to Poetescape. Welcome, everyone. Today, I am very pleased to have as my guest, poet, teacher, and performance poet, Jeffrey McDaniel. How are you, Jeffrey?
I'm very good, Rich. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, man. You know, I've been a big fan and supporter of your work for years now, so I'm very happy that we're able to connect today. Jeffrey McDaniel is the author of Alibi School, The Forgiveness Parade, and The Splinter Factory, all published by Manic Bee Press. Jeffrey's also the author of The Endarkenment and most recently Chapel of Inadvertent Joy, both released by University of Pittsburgh Press. McDaniel's work has appeared in numerous anthologies, including Best American Poetry, The Outlaw Bible of American Poetry, and New American Poetry. He's won several awards, including an NEA fellowship, and teaches creative writing at Sarah Lawrence College. Jeffrey, it's been a while since I've heard you read your work live, and I really do. You're one of those poets who I love to, you know, I love reading you on the page, but I love hearing you read your work live because you bring so much more to the table when you do that. I was hoping we might start today's show with you reading a piece. How's that sound?
That sounds good, Rich. I guess I'll start with the first poem in the book. It's called Hello. The person gazing at this page before you had really amazing eyes, blue the way the Caribbean is blue. That first minute off the plane, someone who grew up in New Jersey. Anyway, it's good you're here. The truth is I've been lonely, crawling up and down the page at night. Life is like this boomerang. You get hurled out and everything is fresh. Then you hit 40, start to arc back to the hand that flung you from the womb, the Lord's hand, and then it's all rerun. I know I'm complaining and that it's unattractive, but please forgive me, because complaining is like sex for old people. Have you ever cringed with your whole body, been so filled with shame you wanted to wriggle out of your flesh, like a serpent in a forest, like the snake that betrayed Eve? No one ever mentions how the snake apologized, how he tried to make it up to them, how the Lord punished the snake too, said, I will fill your kind with so much shame and self-hatred, you will writhe out of yourself every 6 months, just like a man's penis. It's true. Twice a year, men wake and find nothing in their boxers but the empty casings of their runaway fallacies. Anyway, 1875, a Civil War vet from Virginia gets off a boat in England. Everyone calls him Yankee. He cringes, snarls, I ain't no Yankee. I killed Yankees. But after a month, he begins to take it, the way we all begin to take the gray hairs in our underpants, the ring of our anus loosening, our rocket ship struggling to pierce the atmosphere. Now, if you would just lean forward a little, friend, and drag your fragrant strands over my voluptuous grief.
That was Jeffrey McDaniel reading from his latest collection, Chapel of Inadvertent Joy. And that poem again was called Hello. Is that right, Jeffrey?
Yes. Yeah, it's the first poem in the book.
Now, The epigraph for the, while we're sort of talking about the latest collection, the epigraph for, and actually I guess the title of the collection itself, Chapel of Inadvertent Joy, comes from Marina Tsvetaeva. And you use an epigraph from her to start the book. What do you take away from her work? How did she inspire you?
Well, I mean, I've read her in translation. That quote just jumped out at me. I don't know when I first read it, 10 years ago or something. I've read her selected poems. I don't know if it's by Penguin or someone. And there are a number of her poems that that have connected to me, that I've connected to a lot. With the Russian poetry in the 20th century, I think, I don't know how great the translations always are. I think it's a really tough language to translate. I know Ilya Kaminsky and Jean Valentine just translated a bunch of her work. I haven't read their translations yet. But, and I know there are things that I'm not getting about her in her poetry, some of the language playing, some of the experimentation she was doing. But she seems to me to be a really visceral poet, the way I experience her. Also, the story of her life is incredibly tragic, even in the context of, early 20th century Russian poets it's particularly tragic. But that quote just spoke to me. I mean, there was something about that quote that I really liked, and I underlined it years ago and just kept being in love with it. So I borrowed it for the title.
Nice, nice. Well, it's a great title. I mean, it's a very striking title, and when I heard that was going to be the title of your latest collection, it somehow seemed to fit, and it kind of was in keeping. Like, I remember your one of your older collections on Manic D, the Forgiveness Parade, Chapel of Inadvertent Joy almost seems to kind of follow suit with a title like Forgiveness Parade, and so it made complete sense. From what I gather, it seems like your father was a pretty huge inspiration for you when it came to introducing you to reading and later on writing. Can you talk about how he helped to shape your interest in those areas, and perhaps any other inspirations that might have affected you along the way?
Oh, okay. You mean like when I was really little? My father... we had a very close relationship between the ages of, say, 3 and 8, and he would read to me every night, and he would teach me math, and he taught me to play chess, he'd play football with me, and, he read me the story Peter Rabbit so many times he could read it to me in the dark, and he would also make up stories. One of the favorite things I remember is he would make up these stories about, Johnny Bear and Jeffrey, I forget what animal I was, but it was me and my two brothers, the three of us, kind of in the woods, and these haunted tales that I'm sure he doesn't remember, but they were pretty special to me too. And I make up stories for my daughter now, and that's really fun. And he taught me math on an abacus and at an early age, and so those things, I think things that you pick up when you're little, they just start. It feels like they come natural to you, but maybe someone else was responsible too. And, I know it's a two-way street. I had to be receptive to what he was bringing to me for it to stick. My daughter, for instance, she knows how to set up a chessboard, but she doesn't seem that interested in learning how to play chess, but she does, so for whatever reason, I'd be happy to teach her and I've offered to, but she's not as interested in that, but she loves to read, and she's, she reads voraciously. So, I guess each person does have a kind of things that they just sort of gravitate towards.
Right. I mean, now that you're a father, because I've known you for a while now, and, sort of knew you back in the 90s.
17 years, I think we met probably at North by Northwest.
Yes, yes. And, kind of just what you were talking about being a father now, do you ever find it sort of difficult, like perhaps somewhere in your mind you're feeling like, oh, these are certain things I should teach to my daughter, but maybe she, for whatever reason, either isn't interested or whatever, or isn't perhaps ready? Is that ever a struggle that you have sometimes, like what the teacher
I mean,
and at what
you know it's a, you know I think it'll all be okay, you know, as long as your child is interested in some things and you're able, and there's some balance there, I think that's
sure.
That's good, and you know, I think I think it'll be okay. I mean, I also play sports, and I wouldn't mind if she was really like into basketball. But in fact, she's really into gymnastics and
nice.
Really into, like, she takes a hip hop dance class, and she loves those things, and so she does like handstands, and she's learning to do handstands. She does what are they called, somersaults, cartwheels. Does a lot of cartwheels. She does a lot of cartwheels.
Mm-hmm.
In the yard, and those aren't things that I particularly love, but I'm glad that she has something physical that she loves to do, so I don't worry about it too much. No, it's okay.
Nice. So you got into writing and eventually performing poetry. When did you begin performing your poetry?
Well, let's see. I was in high school, and I was feeling, I guess, somewhat alienated or something, or, I don't know, disaffected youth, you know, not applying himself or whatever, and I started to write poems. That I even wrote a poem was a very weird thing, because I was in Philadelphia, which is kind of a provincial, you know, not super artsy place, and I played sports, and I did drugs, and I hung out with kids who, you know, some kids who got in trouble, and then, you know, whatever, and one night I found myself writing a poem called The Roller Coaster of Life, and it was a pretty bad poem, a kind of a rhyming philosophical poem, but I started to write a lot. I started to write. It was like kind of my thing I did, and then there was a school talent show. I also got into dance. I got into popping. I was really into rap music from the age of 12.
Wow.
79, I heard, like, or 78, 79, my swim coach was a guy named Boston Berry from West Philly who drove a Trans Am, and he would take us to these swim meets, like, all over the city, and it was great. You know, it was, like, in the summer, and we'd swim all over. We swam in North Philly and West Philly and South Philly, and it was great, and he listened to rap music, and sometimes at the end of the swim meet, in these public pools around town. We were part of members of like a private swim club in Center City, but we would go to these public pools all over the place. And at the end of the swim meet, sometimes the rival coach and Boston Berry and a couple of other people like start talking trash with each other, and then like be like, "All right, you want to throw down?" And then like the coaches and like the four best swimmers on one side and the four best swimmers on the other, adults included, would have like a swim meet, you know, a race, a relay race, and that was really fun too. That was really like sort of see trash talking involved with swimming was pretty cool. But yeah, I got into rap music, and so I did this performance for my school talent show when I was in 11th grade that I really worked on a lot. I mean, I didn't really try very hard at school. I really wouldn't do my homework that much, or do as little as possible. So I didn't really apply myself, but I really applied myself on this performance, and I memorized all these moves. I tried to mime, and I memorized several poems, and I created this audio tape that was, you know, I recorded just the one speaker of David Bowie, like, you know, Major Tom, and so it's like 10, where you just hear him counting, and it was really a lot of fun, and that was I was in leather pants and makeup, and that was my first reading and my first performance. And, you know, it's a special thing to me because I really didn't have very many models beyond kind of like what I'd like, you know, Ziggy Stardust in this, you know, that movie or rock
sure.
and roll were my models. So I didn't have very many literary models. And
right. And were
yeah,
you well received?
Really you know, it was a school in the suburbs. I lived in the city, but I went to school in the suburbs, and yeah, it was very well received, but I think people were also kind of like, what is going on with this dude? Because Philadelphia is a pretty conservative place. Like, D.C. is a city that, like, if kids who were in private school were really into, like, punk rock. There were some kids there, at least, who were really into punk rock in the early 80s, early to mid-80s, whereas in Philadelphia, it was much more of, like, a lacrosse realm. And
right.
there were a lot fewer people into punk rock. And you know, Philadelphia is like a less developed music scene when it comes to that kind of alternative music, I would say, than somewhere like D.C. Like, D.C. has a record label, Discord. Like, I think Philadelphia had, like, the Dead Milkmen and this guy Brubaker, what was Circle of Shit, maybe, was his band. But there was just like a less developed kind of punk scene, and or hardcore scene. And then in DC, you know, there's Discord, there's that Teen Beat label. It was just a kind of more developed scene. So I don't know. I think they were, you know, my school that I went to several different high schools. I kind of bounced around a little bit. I got evicted from a Quaker school, and I think they, you know, didn't know what to make of me. But yeah, I guess it was received well.
Nice. Well, you just mentioned DC before, and that was actually something I wanted to ask you about, because you actually went on to spend a little bit of time in the DC area. Can you talk about some of your time there and how it might have affected your writing and performance?
Well, I mean, let's see. When I got out of college, I went to grad school in DC, so I went to an MFA program from 1990 to 1993, and you know, outside of DC, and I had kind of mixed feelings about DC. I had lived in, you know, after living in Philadelphia, I went to college in New York and lived in the city a little bit and spent a little time in the city, and you know, and that seemed like the place to me. And DC, when I first moved to the DC area, it seemed like a you know, not New York, and that seemed to be a bad thing. But over time, I began to appreciate the smallness of D.C. and that, you know, and also the fact that it wasn't a cool place. You know, there were only, like, three cool places in D.C. to go. There was, like, you know, D.C. Space, which closed. There was, like, Food for Thought, which was this cafe, and then that was sort of like a hippie cafe, and then but all these punk rock waitresses work there from the band Slant Six, and Gary Lilly, a poet, was the who's now got two books of poetry. He was the dishwasher back then. I don't even know if he was writing then. He was the dishwasher. And then there was a club called the Black Cat.
Oh yeah, the Black Cat. I remember that.
That
place
was a great club. And there was a cafe called Dante's. Own the son of the guy who owned Food for Thought. His son was Dante, and he owned Dante's and the Black Cat. I mean, Dave Grohl was an owner of the Black Cat too. And so, like, there's like three cool places to go. And, you know, most people in D.C. looked kind of conservative, you know, the sort of in Northwest, DuPont Circle were a little more conservative. Whereas somewhere like L.A., you know, people look really different. A lot of people look cool, and there's a lot of body ink, and, you know, there's not a lot of coats and ties. And L.A., it's really about what you look like in a lot of ways. Kind of people really look cool. And D.C. was like people looked really uncool. But it was a great scene, you know. It was a really small poetry scene, but there were real poets there, and I got to, you know, hang out with people. Like, I got this job called Writers' Corps after graduate school, which was a poets in the community job, and I got to hang out with, you know, poets like Kenny Carroll and DJ Renegade and Brian Gilmore, who were part of this group called 8 Rock, and they did readings with, like, the Dark Room Collective. And so there was, like, those poets. I was friends with the people on the slam scene, like Sylvana Straw and Jose Padua, who'd come back from D.C., from New York. And there were, like, language poets like Rod Smith and this guy Mark Wallace. And, you know, it was small enough that we could all interact with each other. Whereas in New York, there's so many poets that, like, you know, even the experimental scene, you know, there's so many, like, little subgenres within what you might call, like, more the avant-garde side of things. So, you know, D.C. was really small, and it was, like, small enough for all the poets to know each other. And it's also a small place. So that was – there were a lot of good things about it. And there was a good music scene.
Right.
And, yeah.
You mentioned the slam scene just before. You did a bit of slamming yourself. How did you get involved in that particular scene? And what are your thoughts on it now, sort of looking back? And you don't do too much slamming now, do you?
No, I mean, I haven't done in a long time.
Right.
But, I was in grad school, and I was at a friend's apartment or something, staying over, and in the Washington Post there was an article about this thing called poetry slams happening at this nightclub. And, you know, it said there was a big crowd for poetry, and that was exciting to me. You know, that there was a crowd for poetry seemed exciting, and I didn't know what to expect. You know, you know, and he read some excerpts of the work, and I didn't think the work that was being excerpted was that strong. But, you know, I think I've always, you know, so on the one hand, I've sort of been attracted to the live scene and taking poetry, you know, being able to read it in front of people. But then maybe there was a little bit of me that was, you know, bringing a little bit of that poem on the page mentality. So I think I was a little, you know, in two worlds or something in my head. But yeah, I went. And actually in D.C. it was a pretty good scene. I mean, it was really easy to make the national slam team back then compared to how it is now. I mean, to get on a slam team, I think you have to, like, you know, there's all these really complex systems. Much harder to make the high school poetry slam. Like, to make the high school poetry slam in New York City, I think it's really, really hard, really serious. Many competitions and many contestants back then I won one slam, then I was in the final, you know, there was the final of the eight winners, and then I made the team, and next thing you know, I was in San Francisco, and different cities back then had different vibes, and so DC had a kind of a diverse vibe, and there was some good writing, and I thought we were kind of interesting, and meeting people from that world was pretty cool. I mean, I went back a few times. I think ultimately it was something, you know, I got a lot out of that world, and I toured a lot, and I still sometimes do readings at slam venues.
Right.
But, you know, the competition was something that was, it was a something I moved through as opposed to an end in itself or something.
Yeah. You know, because you are very strong in both areas, on the page and, you know, when performing live, you know, is there a difference for you in writing poems for performance versus writing poems for publication? Meaning, do you find yourself paying more attention to certain things while writing in either situation?
Nah, I mean, you know, then weirdly, most of the poems of mine that did the best in slams were also the poems that did the best on the page. I don't think we writers, especially when as a writer, you don't always know which poem of yours is, you know, you don't know really how the outside world's responding to your work. I guess in live readings, you get the sense of, especially in a slam, you kind of really immediately know if something had an impact or not, not just from the
right.
scores, but from the feeling in the room.
Yep.
And I think you need that. It's certainly worth respecting that. On the page, it sometimes takes a lot longer to sort of understand how people are responding, and because there's not a kind of, it's not a visceral connection. It's much slower, and I guess with the internet, maybe there are ways that you can track things or something. But I don't know too much about all that technology stuff around that. But yeah, I mean, I just write, you know, now I don't perform that much now, so I
right.
write, and then it feels like this book that I just wrote, it doesn't feel at all performative.
No, yeah.
Maybe there's a kind of character in a way that I feel like I slip into when I read from it, somehow,
mm-hmm.
a character that I don't quite understand so much, but I don't know that any of these poems would do well in a slam, and I think that they're not really audience friendly, but then sometimes people respond to them. So,
yeah. Well, they're definitely, I would feel, I mean, especially with this latest collection, this was something that I noticed because, you know, I've read a number of your books now, and I would, while maybe you might not consider them quote unquote audience friendly per se, I definitely consider your work to be reader friendly. I mean, some of the pieces in this latest collection are extremely personal. I mean, even more personal in a way than perhaps some of the other pieces of yours that I've read. And I'm curious how, and in certain ways it feels like maybe you were even taking some chances because some of the pieces seem to be so deep and dark and personal. I was hoping you might share your thoughts on how you put the collection together, how you view the work in the latest collection, and how it might compare to some of your previous work.
Well, you know, I guess I could say that the book does feel more vulnerable. I don't know if it's more personal because it feels less directly autobiographical, but somehow it feels more vulnerable. And it feels like it's from a deeper place, but it's, even though I think there's probably a smaller percentage of poems that I could point to and say are coming from my direct life or something like that. So, this, I think as poets, there's this funny thing that happens where more and more, I think we're in an era right now, the past 10 years or so, where poets really are thinking of books as a collection, like trying to make a book that's structured and fits together in an interesting way. So like building a book, whereas my first poetry teacher was a guy named Tom Lux, whose approach was kind of like, hey, you write your best 40, you take your best 40 poems from over 5 years and put them together, you put a little order into it, but it's really about the individual poems and you let other people figure out what the themes are and don't get worried too much about that. I think there's that approach, but I think that more and more in the past 10 years, there are books that really have sort of a concept or are really trying to come together as books. And I think there was a consciousness on my part here. I think this feels like the most, feels the most cohesive or something out of anything I've written. But at the same time, the funny thing is when poets, when you die as a poet, if you're lucky, only if you're lucky, which there is no, absolutely no guarantee, if you're lucky, your books will be, individual poems will be ripped out of your books and put into some anthology. That's the best, the best that you can hope for. What I'm calling a collection now, I don't think will exist. They will rip it apart and there'll be an anthology. I don't think that when we read T.S. Eliot, we don't think about, like, collections. Maybe we do with someone like W.S. Merwin, but even, over time, more and more I think that the poems get ripped out of the books they came from. And if you're lucky, in 100 years, you just have whatever poems that are left. So, as more and more time goes by, they're next to each other, but yet we don't know as much about how different the individual poems might be from each other, or how someone, even 10 years in a person's life, you can go through a lot of changes, and so the work could come from a different place or something. But anyway,
absolutely. Why don't you go ahead and read another poem for us?
Okay. Let's read. Let's read, "Beware of the dark sedan idling inside you." I flick a switch. Out flashes the light bulb, like God snapping his fingers in my face. Wake up, pumpkinhead. I've been running around half naked with the rest of America, wearing only a credit card and a cashmere scarf. Arf, arf. Yesterday I went to Circuit City's going out of business sale to revel in the fall of capitalism. But all I saw were the sad faces of underpaid workers. Welcome to the land of the free fall and the freebaser, as well as the freelancer and freeloader and front-loading washing machine where you can empty your conscience and wash all those illicit thoughts about illegal immigrants out of your brain. Where it's still okay to dock your canoe at the racist joke island at cocktail parties and chuckle. Two housewives bang prescription medicine bottles and whisper tears. An hour opens its trench coat and shows you stolen minutes. A homeless man gets a boner while sleeping on a steam grate. There's a dark car idling inside you. Question is, do you get in?
Nice. That was Jeffrey McDaniel reading once again from his latest collection, Chapel of Inadvertent Joy. Jeffrey, I remember reading this collection and reading that particular poem, which was really a wonderful poem. And then again in another piece, reading a reference to this dark sedan again about the woman sort of getting taken away in a dark sedan by an old boyfriend of hers from high school or something. And I was like, oh, there's that dark sedan again. And I was curious if there was anything to that. Did that kind of take you by surprise yourself?
Well, you know, it's funny. Yeah. You know, I wanted to have other dark sedan poems. I had this wish for there being like four or five to sort of be driving through the book, but it didn't work. And that's an interesting thing when you're mixing with a sequence, you start wanting, you know, not so much in that one, but I think I tried a couple of others. I think I had one other dark sedan poem that I dropped. I think there were three. And then the third one, I didn't like as much. And, I have, you know, a sequence of poems, another sequence in here, and, you know, there are 15 poems thematically connected, and I there was a period where every poem I wrote, I felt like I could add a line and make it connect to that sequence, so that's an interesting thing.
Right. Right.
But yeah, the dark sedan, I was sort of, I had a wish for it, but it didn't materialize, and I didn't want to force it, I don't know.
Right, right. You were originally published by a good friend of ours, Jen Joseph, at Manic Deep Press. How did that come about for you?
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing. It came directly out of the National Poetry Slam in San Francisco. I went out there. I went out there in September of 93. I went out there. I was still in graduate school when I was on the DC Slam team with a guy named Miles David Moore, Sylvana Straw, and another guy named Ed, who I forget. And we got on the slam team and we flew out. They bought us a plane ticket to San Francisco, and I stayed with my buddy Saren Sakurai in the Lower Haight, and it was great, man. It was so much fun. And the first night at the slam, we didn't even know what the rules were back then. In 93, we were doing slam differently in D.C., than they were doing anywhere else. We were doing it at the end of each round, the audience cheers, and whoever they cheer the loudest for, then you go on to the next round. So
Right.
We did it like that you cheer. We didn't realize that they were using numbers with individual judges, so that was a big shock. And then also in D.C., you read three poems per round. So to win an individual slam with eight contestants, you had to read nine poems in one night. And if there was a tie, you had to read a tenth poem. So it really, in D.C., it was really more about having a wide range of work. Whereas that's not really that great of a slam strategy for the National Slam. The best slam strategy is to have like three killer poems. And so in New York, there'd be people with like three blockbusters. And then maybe there's not much after that. But, you know, we went out there. We didn't know what was going on. So the first night kind of got blown out of the water, and I don't know. I personally did a bad job. And then the next day, there's something about a slam. You feel like you definitely can feel like you've been kicked to the ground or something like that. I mean, you can feel knocked down. And I had a degree of success at the National Slam. I mean, it seemed like I think I went to four of them, and every year there'd be some high point. There'd be one or two really high moments. But all four times I think I went, I think there was a low moment, a moment where I felt, you know, kicked to the ground and kind of this challenging moment. Whereas I think the top slammers are, you know, it's like consistent every night. So the next night I just read my poem straight, and I had it sort of different, switched up some things. And John Longy, Jen Joseph's husband, was hanging out with me.
Sure.
We were doing something, I forget what, behind the venue together. Maybe we were sharing a cigarette or something like that. I remember there's a guy named Pat Storm was back there. He passed away, but he was in the Asheville team. We had a bottle of whiskey back there too, and that was a lot of fun. But John Longy was just matter of factly like, oh, you know, I think my wife Jen Joseph would like to do your book, and I was like, cool, you know, I was like, oh wow. So she saw me read, and that's sort of how it happened at the slam.
Great.
And that
nice.
Was, you know, the poetry world was much more factionalized back then. And there weren't all these new hip presses. There are so many cool little presses that are popping up all over the place. That I guess that began to happen in my mind sometime in the late 90s, where
right.
suddenly there's a much more open landscape. And before that, it was really like, you know, in the early 90s, it was like, you know, the Yale Series for Younger Poets was like, and the National Poetry Series were like the big awards to win. And, you know, it was a kind of a controlled, factionalized world. Language poets over here, performance poets over here, mainstream narrative poets here, neo-formalists here. And it seems like, you know, somewhere around 99, 2000, somewhere all hell broke loose. Now it's like kind of a free-for-all, which I would compare to like sort of historically to something like 1963. It seems like in the early 60s was when poetry, you know, in the wider poetry world, things sort of opened up and poets were, someone yelled recess and poets could run in any different direction. And and I think we're in a period of that now, too, where sort of everything's on the table and it's a period of openness.
Right.
As compared to like the 1950s, which if you look at the mainstream, things are very narrow. Of course, the margins are vibrant in the 50s. That's often how, I guess, when the mainstream is narrow, then the margins get fertile. And I think the same thing happened in the 80s. The Poetry Slam kind of, you know, was a revolt in some ways against the stuffiness of, you know, mainstream poetry in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah.
Do you...
That's how I met Jennifer and John.
Nice. What are your thoughts on where poetry might go from where it is today?
I have no idea. No, I wish I did. I mean, I guess, you know, if we look at sort of patterns, we would think that there will be some kind of narrowing back down into factions, but what those factions will be, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
That seems You know, like look at modernism, 1910, 1913, like T.S. Eliot comes out with the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. Ezra Pound's the one who's like saying that Eliot modernized himself. Well, he was reading French poets, I mean, I think in college, and I think that helped him. So, you know, and you know, in those eras, you know, Ezra Pound saying make it new. So the poets are all trying to be different and doing different things. But by the 1950s, you know, that's all that wild modernism has become. We've got new criticism. We've got the well-wrought urn. You know, there's a big essay about how poetry should be like a well-wrought urn, like a vase made out of words with no
right.
None of the author's personality. It's like, you know, emotion recollected in tranquility. And it's, you know, you look at mainstream poetry in the 1950s, W.S. Merwin, James Wright, Robert Lowell. Robert Lowell said at some point he didn't even know what he was talking about in his poems. You know, he didn't, and he saw people like Dylan Thomas and Allen Ginsberg really connecting with audiences, and he knew he needed to change things up. And he writes Life Studies in 1960, but Eliot is, it becomes part of the problem. He's one of the original people who opens things up, and then some of his criticism pushes us this era of intense impersonality. And you could say that then by the 1980s, it's the opposite. It's a cult of personality. The 50s were highly formal, very, very elevated formal work, but with no personality. By the 1980s, there's a lot of first-person driven work, even in the mainstream, that's maybe shapeless or formless and doesn't have a lot of verbal energy. And so I think language poetry in some ways is rebelling against the self-indulgence of the first person. I think, you know, sometimes the neo-formalists as well might be rebelling against that, and maybe poetry slams were too. It's a really weird era we're in now. I don't, you know, with FLARF and conceptual poetry, I don't know where things will be going. I love poets who seem to be immune to sort of their time period, like the norms of their era, like someone like Theodore Rutke seemed to be doing really interesting work that seems like a precursor to confessional poetry, like My Papa's Waltz. I love people who seem to be immune to like their era.
Right, right. You know, your work can have surreal, even comedic elements at time, but you always seem to anchor the work in a certain emotional coherence. When you're working on a certain piece, is that what comes first, the emotional coherence for you, and then you spin out from there into other ideas, surreal or comedic, or do you sometimes begin a poem from the abstract and then try to anchor it to an emotional core later on?
Well, I would think that, like, if, you know, we're looking at a book that's 71 pages or something like that, there's probably 150 pages that have fallen by the wayside. And some of them fell by the wayside because they were maybe comedic but didn't have anything else going on. You know,
right.
And so then there are other poems that you know, maybe lacked, you know, were serious but lacked some kind of energy. So there are a lot of poems that fell away. I don't know about the process in terms of, like, you know, I'd have to look at individual poems and sort of think about that specific, I hope to feel something when I write, whether it's a jolt of dark humor,
right?
You know, or I like to feel that in life, and I also like to feel something visceral. You know, if I'm having an emotional experience when I'm writing, hopefully that translates. Doesn't always,
yeah.
but sometimes it does, and, you know, it's.
I saw this when I was reading some about you online. You mentioned something about Socrates, and he once said something along the line of, metaphor is the only thing about poetry writing that can't be taught. You know, that said, I'm really curious about how you've gone about developing your use of metaphor, because you're one of those writers I really love to read who comes up with some of the most inventive, touching, and humorous metaphors that I've ever read. Do those, when you're writing, do a lot of those just come naturally, or do some of those come later on in the sort of editing, revising process?
Well, Rich, that's interesting. I mean, because, you know, and I didn't say that what you quoted. I think maybe Tom Lux said that about me or something.
Oh, okay.
And Tom Lux might have said that. And I don't even know if it was Aristotle who said that or who. But anyway, I don't know that I totally agree that metaphor can't be taught. I mean, I started to read a lot of there's no real good name for what we would call these poets in the 1960s in America. I mean, they would all hate to be called neo-surrealists, but like James Tate, Charles Simic, Bill Knott, they were really important to me when I was like 19, and they still are. I still like their work. I still am interested in some of their poems a great deal.
I got
and then when I was in grad
James
school,
Tate because I saw that you liked him.
Yeah, and then in grad school, there was a woman named Cindy Goff and a guy named Greg Grummer, and we were really interested in surrealism. Carolyn Forché had a class on, you know, avant-garde movements of the 20th century, and we devoured surrealism. We started to read lots of surrealism, and Cindy and I would do kind of surrealist exercises. There was this surrealist book of games, and we were just trying to generate imagery. And I think if you know, what we did was it seemed like we poured lots of surrealism into our heads and kept trying and trying and would throw away the things that we didn't like and keep the ones that we did and you know, but looking for some kind of narrative. Looking for some kind of emotional energy, not necessarily narrative or an archipelago or something kind of emotional pulse. So it wasn't just a kind of an intellectual exercise. But I think you can strengthen your metaphorical muscle. I think you can if you read a lot of stuff that does that and you think along those lines and try and keep doing exercises or writing in that vein, I think you can strengthen whatever muscle you have there.
Yeah. Well, speaking of writing,
that's something I'm interested in. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of writing and exercises and that sort of thing, you teach at Sarah Lawrence College, and actually a friend of mine, Ben Brandstein, actually studied with you and just,
oh, yeah.
You know. I would every once in a while check in with Ben when he would come back to LA to ask how things were going, and he just loved studying with you. I'm curious, what's a Jeffrey McDaniel class look like at Sarah Lawrence?
Well, you know, a workshop really, a lot of it is involves the students that are there. And I mean, I've been there for 13 years now. Ben was in a class that was really a good class for me to be a part of. But as time has gone by, you know, when I was in school as an undergrad and even a grad student, a poetry workshop, there'd be no reading list. You know, you would just go up, bring in and bring your poems, and you would spend the whole class just going over student poems. And I took one class that was a reading and writing poetry, and that was really useful. Tom Lux taught that. And we would look at, like, poems like Yusuf Komunyak and do these close reads, and that was very helpful. So my workshops are themed often. So let's say I might do a class like the so-called Confessional Poets that looks at, you know, we read a book a week. We read a book a week. And, sorry, my wife is bringing me some tomato sauce thing I need to open. Okay, there you go. In my studio. But we'll read a book a week and talk about it in class. So we'll read a book and then we'll talk about it as a group. And Ben had great, great comments. And so we'll discuss the book, and then every student will read a poem out loud, and then we'll workshop for the second hour and 15 minutes or something like that. So it's like Nice. Each class is kind of a reading and writing workshop. I'm doing a class now called like Hybrids of Poetry and Prose, where I'm looking at hybrid texts. I've been working on this sort of novel memoir thing, and for the past, off and on for the past like 12 or 13 years, and hopefully it's about ready to go out there. Started as a 691-page mess. Actually started as a screenplay at UCLA Extension, and then it turned into a 691-page mess, and now it's 363 pages, and hopefully it's ready to be seen by the world. But it's hybrid-y, and so we read things like, we start out with James Baldwin, Notes of a Native Son, which isn't really hybrid-y, but, you know, it kind of is. And then we have a book called Bluettes by Maggie Nelson, who I think teaches at CalArts, The Balloonists by Eula Biss. We read Michael Martone by Michael Martone, Anne Carson. A guy named Morris Manning has a book called Lawrence Booth's Book of Visions. That's pretty good. Letters to Yesenin by Jim Harrison, who went on to write, I think, Dances with Wolves. So that was all these letter poems to the Russian poet Sergei Yesenin. So, yeah, the reading lists are a big part of the class. And so I've learned a lot as a thinker and a reader at Sarah Lawrence with my students. I mean, that's been a big thing. You know, there are not that many writing exercises. I guess I give props, but it's you know, half the class is reading and writing, and that's been useful for me. Because I used to be, you know, read for myself and pick and choose and read a poem here. If I bought a book, I'd read a few poems here, a few poems there. But now when I'm teaching a book, I have to read it methodically and read through it and think about it as a collection. And it's been good. It's been good for me.
Yeah. We're getting close to the end of our time. I was hoping you could read one last poem from the new collection.
Okay.
Cool.
Did you have a specific one, or is it?
No, why don't you go ahead and choose?
Okay. I'll read the last poem of the book. Chapel of Inadvertent Joy. 1 minute you're hissing at your wife about something trivial. The next you're stomping derelict train tracks when it emerges. Its spires shooting up between your ribs. Your gaze swivels skyward and catches a clutch of birds glittering over a smokestack, sparkling back and forth in the sky in various formations like a math equation being worked out in the mind of a genius. Always pull the car over when you spot a teen punk rock show at dusk in a public park. Always drink a glimpse of a white horse in a sunlit pasture at the end of summer. Always laugh when the garden hose slips out of your hand and sprays you in the face. When they said, smell the roses, they didn't tell you that every day the rose changes, that first you must identify the rose. Today, you're in a field by the Hudson. ribbons of nectar spool from a folk singer's lips. Your wife and daughter lollygag in the grass. Sunlight drizzles through tree leaves, an organic stained glass window. Feel the convergence of all your stray voltage. Don't pull out of that feeling. But the father standing next to you, see your eyes well up. The inverse of how the neighbors sometimes hear you yelling, fuck. It's true. You don't deserve this. But it's yours anyway. The gold-tipped spurs of this moment. A red bird flinging praise through the sky.
That was Jeffrey McDaniel reading the title poem from his collection, Chapel of Inadvertent Joy. I love that line, feel the convergence of all your stray voltage. Man, what a beautiful poem. Jeffrey, one last question for you. Back in 1999, you were quoted in the LA Times as saying, it's the most revolutionary act to pick up a book and read because so many people just turn on a TV. I'm curious, do you still believe that to be the case, or has that opinion changed in any way?
I watch a lot of basketball on TV. I don't know if I think it's the most revolutionary thing anymore. I think reading is a great thing, though. I mean, I don't want to say for other people, but for me, like if I read a little bit today, I was able to practice what I'm preaching. I was able to read a little bit of Night of the Iguana by Tennessee Williams. I'm reading that. And my father gave me all these plays. I've been seeing a lot of off-Broadway and Broadway plays in New York on the cheap the past few years. And so I'm reading that. Tennessee Williams is a really good writer, it seems. And and then also this book my dad got me on race and something. It was actually pretty good. So so that's been good. And I'm interviewing my father as well. I'm working this audio project. I have no idea where it's going, but I'm interviewing people I grew up with. And I'm also interviewing my dad. And so I don't know what's going to happen with this. But so you brought him up at the beginning, so he's kind of come back into the picture. But just like when I read, I think more, and I'm feeding my inner life. And sometimes I forget to do it, but I'm almost never unhappy after I've done it.
Nice. Well, speaking of your dad, what does he think of your work?
He's I think supportive of it, you know, and he's excited about it.
Nice.
He's read my books, and I've sent him a book of poems before, and he's given me fairly decent, you know, sophisticated feedback. You know, he's more comfortable. He retired a few years ago, and he seems to read a lot of nonfiction. He'd rather read a book about the classics than read a classic, which to me is problematic. But he reads a lot, and he wants to discuss books with me. And he didn't like the first draft of my my memoiristic novel, but I'm about to give him a new draft after Thanksgiving. So hopefully he'll appreciate it more. And yeah, so he's been what I guess I'd call a supporter.
Nice. That must feel good. I mean, to like, you know, your father being one of the, you know, earliest influences in regards to your reading and writing, and now be able to, you know, share these gifts with him. That must feel really good. That's amazing.
Well, yeah, Jeffrey, we'll see what happens with this book of interviews. Well, these interviews, I don't know what it'll evolve into, but you know, he's definitely a very good conversationalist, and he loves to tell stories.
Nice. What's the best way for people to find out about you online, or for people to get a hold of your books?
Oh boy, you know, I have a website that I just have to finish. I've been dragging my feet for 5 years, so hopefully I'll get that off the ground soon. In the interim, geez, I don't know, Facebook maybe, or
okay.
Send me an email. My email is jmcdaniel@slc.edu. That's my work email, and that's a public email, so someone could reach me there. Or, and my book, I mean, I guess online or something like that. You could get it
sure.
There. And yeah.
Yeah. Well, with me today has been Jeffrey McDaniel, author most recently of Chapel of Inadvertent Joy, released by University of Pittsburgh Press. Jeffrey, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been so great to reconnect with you.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been very good talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Yeah, I also want to send out a big thank you to our show's sponsor for all your writerly needs. Please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julie at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also,
oh,
a big
Rich,
thanks
to I have one other
yes.
thing.
Please.
I don't know if I can remember it or not. There was an L.A. poet, Wanda Coleman, who passed
yes,
away
passed
on Friday.
Away. Yes, I was going to bring
that
up earlier.
I started writing a kind of broken haiku about her.
Do you have it?
I have to see if I remember it.
Go
Blustery,
for it.
November sky dragging no. Blustery November wind dragging Wanda's cantankerous spirit across a chalkboard sky.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Yeah.
Really windy day in New York today. It was just super, super windy. The wind, it must have been like 25-30 mile an hour wind. Things were just whipping all over the place. And I kept thinking it's Wanda's spirit being dragged across the sky.
Nice.
Anyway.
Well, this show is officially dedicated to Wanda because she's been such a huge inspiration for me. And thank you for chiming in to read that because I was really saddened yesterday when I saw that news. Tune in next week when I'll be featuring actually a pre-recorded interview with L.A. writer, art critic, and artist Shayna Neist-Embrott. Shayna shared loads of humorous and insightful thoughts on art, culture, and writing. You won't want to miss that. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thank you for tuning in to Poetescape. And Wanda, wherever you are, dragging across that chalkboard sky, keep on doing what you do. Thanks again, everyone. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thanks, Rich. Bye.